Welcome to Understory, this 23rd day of October 2019. I'm Elizabeth Poe. Around and about your suburbs, you may have seen your local council workers or subcontractors spraying glyphosate. On one cycle commute, Understory reporter Adrian Glamorgan came upon a happy sprayer who wasn't using gloves for the pesticide, as it is not mandated. The worker said it was completely safe. A number of key agencies have given Roundup and glyphosate a tick, saying there is no evidence of it being a carcinogen. However, the International Agency for Research on Cancer, the IARC, classified glyphosate as probably carcinogenic to humans in 2015, suggesting not all that is sprayed freely on nature verges and rose gardens may be incident-free. In March 2019, in the US, a man claiming Roundup was involved in his cancer case was ultimately awarded $26 million, leading to Costco to stop stocking that product on their shelves. While the judge in the appeal case said the evidence was equivocal, he also found that it, quote, easily supported a conclusion that Monsanto was more considered with the tamping down safety inquiries and manipulating public opinion than it was with ensuring its product is safe, unquote. The judge also said that Monsanto showed a lack of concern about the risk that its product might be carcinogenic. In that case, discovery of Monsanto emails revealed that a research paper that was meant to counter the IARC's findings that glyphosate causes cancer might be answered by adding a couple of significant scientists' names on the publication. Quote, "We would be keeping the cost down by us doing the writing, and they would just edit and sign their names, so to speak," unquote. To understand the issues more deeply, we are revisiting a topic and interview from the end of last year about research known as the Poison Papers. Some decades ago, in a far-off land, there were planes spraying 245T over an area of forest where young children were playing. Their mother then cared for their nosebleeds, bloody diarrhea and headaches, while also hearing of other neighbours falling ill, some having miscarriages, and of their findings of animals dead or with bizarre deformities. The children's mother, Carol Van Strum, wanted the poisoning stopped, and the struggles that ensued led her through lawsuits that brought a temporary ban on 245T, that's one half of Agent Orange, in her area of Oregon, the United States, in 1977, and ultimately to a total stop to the chemical's use in 1983. There were many who noticed the information Van Strum was uncovering about the dangers of industrial chemicals, including some truly shocking revelations of chemical companies' cover-ups, collusions, and lies about some particularly toxic contaminants. Eventually, Carol Van Strum's collection of 100,000 documents gathered over those decades of research has been published online on the website called The Poison Papers. The work is only beginning for this information and more like it to be thoroughly utilised. Understory met with Dr. Jonathan Latham, who's been working with The Poison Papers.
So my name is Jonathan Latham, and I am a PhD molecular biologist. So I was trained as a virologist, and then I did 3 years of medical research in academia. And now I'm the co-founder of the Bioscience Resource Project, along with Alison Wilson.
Now, you're very keen on an evidence-based approach. Can you describe to us what science is meant to be, and then we can talk about what's been missing from the chemicals industry approach to science?
You know, one of my favorite scientific quotes is, science is the belief in the ignorance of experts. It's from Richard Feynman, who is a physicist. And the whole point of that quote is to emphasize the fact that if you become a scientist, you can learn the facts and so on and so forth. But the point about those facts is that they are disputable. They may be based in a theorem or a set of frameworks that is incorrect. And you have to, as a scientist, you have to understand that your peers and your, you know, the people you look up to as the scientists who came before you were probably wrong in what they thought. Otherwise, you wouldn't bother being a scientist because everything would be discovered and everything would be sorted and there'd just be some details left to fill in. You know, the more I go through my scientific career, if you like, the more I understand that truth of that statement. That really we have some very deep misunderstandings actually about science, and many of them are about regulatory science, they're about toxicity of chemicals, they're about the, you know, coming into the sociology, they're about the practical behavior of the chemical industry and its attempts to manipulate the scientific process. And so there are many avenues in which, you know, science is a thing that is different from what is taught in schools, as in a rote set of facts.
Well, you're very critical of the way that chemical industry manages science and manages regulators. Can you just give us a very thumbnail sketch of how that all works?
So what is going on is that there is a political aspect to the job of chemical regulation. Imagine that you're a regulator and you are, you know, a middle ranking or a junior person in that system, and you're confronted with evidence of lack of safety. You know, the treatment groups for a new chemical being developed by an industry are showing evidence of harm. You know, there has elevated levels of tumors and so forth. What you have to do is you have to ask yourself a very fundamental question. And that fundamental question is also something, by the way, that scientists have to deal with, right? Are you going to change the world with your science? And if you are going to change the world, are you going to get pushback from that? And this is the question that regulators have to ask themselves. You know, we find evidence of harm, and then we have to basically confront the possibility that we have to upend the business model or the new product of some big-time industry. And the question for the regulators then becomes, maybe you wish to do that as an individual, but can your agency? Do you have the political backing in the center of power to which you report, and so on and so forth? There's all these questions that become extremely pertinent at that point. Right? You shouldn't, as a regulator, expect that everything is just going to be approved. We call it an approval process, but that's a chemical industry word, right? It's not necessarily an approval process, and that's not necessarily the only outcome. And so chemical industry's role in this is in part to put pressure on those regulators. The other chemical industry role is to supply arguments that essentially regulators can use to absolve chemicals, for example, or GMOs of blame. So what you see in regulatory conferences and toxicology conferences is that the chemical industry and the GMO industry and the biotech industry are supplying arguments for regulators to use to absolve their products of blame, right? They're subtly introducing into the discussion through academic intermediaries ideas that then become the norm of the regulatory industry. Those norms are essentially become favorable towards approvals and the chemical industry as an institution.
A few years ago, we interviewed the chief scientist from the SANS, and it was clear from that conversation that companies don't have to provide the evidence, they just have to say that they've got the evidence. That makes it even further away from a regulator's capacity to oversee, isn't it?
Yeah. So what is going on here is, in our view, regulators, they don't, you know, they understand they don't have the political ability to dispense of these products, except going outside. You know, they can always go outside of normal channels, but let's assume that they'd stay within the normal channels of the political process. They don't have the personal will, the political commitment to actually protect the public under these circumstances. So then they're faced with difficult decisions. How do you, as a regulator, actually respond when there is some evidence of chemical toxicity or GMO toxicity? And the answer is, you take some of the arguments supplied by the chemical industry. But the second thing that you do is you try to outsource the problem. Right? If you are as far away from the actual development of those experiments and the actual testing process itself, then what you do is you allow the possibility for corruption to occur before it even reaches the regulator.
It's a kind of intellectual corruption in a way, isn't it?
It is. We don't have that much evidence that actual money changes hands you know, we have evidence of revolving doors, we have evidence of some kind of specifics, but for the most part, what's really interesting about the papers that we have is they show the arguments going back and forth. They show the evidence that regulators, for example, overlook fraud in chemical testing, that inadequate data is submitted, and so on and so forth. So you see the process of the outsourcing, and you see the process of all the excuses that are made up by internally by these officials. And so that's something that's never been revealed before.
In a public meeting in the Peppermint Grove Library last year, Jonathan Latham told the critical story of a chemical testing company fraud case in the United States from the 1970s and 80s. This 7-year investigation of important testing not completed, of falsified reports of many thousands of chemicals, showed collusion between the Environmental Protection Agency and a chemical testing company to prevent disruption of the chemical industry. These and other findings showed a great contempt for the EPA, the process of reportage, and thus criminal disregard for the public. Jonathan continues to research this thread.
And so dioxins are the contaminants of Agent Orange that resulted in harm to millions of Vietnam vets, harm to millions of people who lived in Vietnam and those parts of Asia, neighboring countries of Asia. You know, what's really interesting about those papers is they also demonstrate the perfidy of companies themselves. Like a lot of what interests us personally about the poison papers is the regulators, right? The actual actions of government officials. So that is what's unique and special about these papers in many respects. But the evidence that they hold, these papers hold about dioxins, will, you know, forever disabuse someone who thinks that, you know, a company would never bring a harmful product to market. You know, there are conversations in there, basically letters going back and forth saying that dioxins are more dangerous than even a researcher can, you know, no one should even research these compounds because they're too dangerous even to do that. And yet the companies continue to make those products. And so you know, these are astounding admissions of guilt on the part of companies who are basically poisoning people. You know, all chemical companies produce probable dangerous substances. One could argue that Monsanto is more successful in its aggressive promotion of those substances. It's more aggressive in its understanding of going into those dark places and then doing something about it. I mean, there's an astounding tale of how, you know, there was basically no evidence to show that actual humans were harmed by dioxins, with the exception that there were 3 papers produced by Monsanto that were published in famous journals that appeared to show no carcinogenic effects of dioxins. And those papers essentially got the chemical industry off the hook for the harms that they did in Vietnam and to vets and so on and so forth. And it turned out that those 3 papers were all fraudulent. So they got off these incredibly important legal cases that basically set a precedent for the whole direction of the dioxin discussion. And they essentially got off scot-free as a result of scientific fraud.
The poison papers. Why should people take a look at that website?
The website itself is very small. The papers are quite... there's a lot of them. There's 3 tons of papers, 20,000 documents, 250,000 pages. So, you know, if you're an academic, if you're a journalist, you know, these are the kinds of things that are going to be really interesting to you. They are original sources. If you're a member of the public, probably what you should do is, at least to start with, you should take a look at the links that are on there, which take you to specific examples of articles that are written about different aspects of these papers that sew the stories together to put them in their context. But we really welcome people pursuing new lines of research, right? There's totally room for somebody who knows relatively little to go along and basically, you know, investigate something, you know, put into that database your favorite toxic chemical or least favorite toxic chemical or your location and see if there's something to do with your city or your country or your state. So we would love that to happen.
Yeah, I just feel like the Poison Papers are an important source of information for journalists and academics to explore. Why wouldn't governments be resourcing that?
You know, it's early days yet. Our plan is to make them part of a university library. And so that will make them more available and more kind of credible, if you like, in some people's minds. So perhaps they will, but I think, you know, people power is what's going to prevail in this case. You know, if we can get this information to enough people, then enough people will understand that their governments have failed them. Because essentially, you know, when you think about it, when you're asking governments to take action over this, you're asking them to take action against themselves, right? Which is not something that's happened too often.
As of mid-2019, there were 18,400 individual lawsuits in the US alleging that glyphosate, the active ingredient in Roundup herbicide, caused them to develop cancer. I'm Elizabeth Poe. You can listen again and share this program and hundreds of other essential understory environmental stories online via the RTRFM website. Thanks to Dr. Jonathan Latham and understory reporter Adrian Glamorgan. I'm Elizabeth Poe. Tune in again next week at the same time, same planet, as we bring plenty more to explore on Understory.